Hey everyone, welcome to the Grabs Podcast. I'm your host today, Grant. With me today, I got Craig Bronson. He's from St. Cloud, Florida, and we're going to be talking about a fire that they were on where grabs were made, and that was in February of 2020. So, Craig, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing well. Tell us a little bit about yourself and about your fire department.
So, started my career, I've been a fireman now for 13 years, started with Polk County. Then made my way over to St. Cloud Fire Department over here. We got currently right now we have four engines, four rescues, and we have a fly. So we got 74 personnel, between medics, EMTs, and firemen. One battalion chief cover about 19 square miles of the city and about 60,000. Little over 60,000 plus residents.
And for non-Florida people, what's a rescue for you guys?
So rescue, we have, it has a fireman, an EMT, or a fireman and a paramedic. But it has everything, air packs. They have all their gear, stuff like that. It's not like an ambulance per se, but it's there. They can go interior on stuff. It's just what we call them down here for. They still transport to the hospitals.
Nice. All right, what are you guys getting on a first alarm for a house fire?
So currently, right now, it's four engines and three rescues and one battalion chief.
And then who's doing what when you guys get on a fire? Do you have SOGs, pre-arrival assignments? Is it incident command driven or what?
We do. So first engine, just basic engine company operations. Our rescues will act as our truck team right now, our inside and outside. So we might have two rescues, one goes interior, the other one does, if it has to be done, VES or something like that. But most of the time, our rescues will do primary search, and we try to harp on that pretty hard to get it all clear. And like our goal is that 4.5 minutes. That's our goal every time, no matter what.
Nice. Sounds like a pretty aggressive search culture. So can you describe that search culture and how you got to that point?
Yeah, so we, being part of the training collaborative for my department, we harp on the search. No matter, we're constantly, anytime we do even initial company operation training, we will throw search in there with it, just because that's how, priority is life safety, right? So no matter what we do, we always try to incorporate some kind of search, even if it's just VES or a quick rapid primary with clear visibility. All of our rescues do have ticks on them. So normally the medic who's in charge of the rescue will have the tick on him, and we teach a kind of tick oriented search if possible, if the ticks don't ever fail because technology fails. But that's our goal, is a tick oriented search. And our main thing is right handed. But of course, that's going to dictate, if fire's left, we're going to go left, or victim's left, we're going to go left. And we teach work to the fire and then work your way back.
Nice. Cool. And then you mentioned VES. So you guys got VESs in the toolbox. You guys are allowed to use that?
Oh, absolutely. We started doing it probably about 6 years ago now. And now it's kind of just the standard for us to do VES. So it's, backside of the fire. Obviously, the primary team can't get to it. We go to the backside, and that's when we VES. We do a two-man VES, so one person will stay at the window. Kind of trying to change that, but our department's so young with so many new guys, and just it's more of a safety aspect for the new guys, because our new guys will go into a rescue. So we might have two people in the rescue that have less than 2 years on. So we're kind of watching out for them while trying to get the search done.
Yeah, right on. So take me to this call, February 2020, and run this down for us.
Okay. So a little backstory on it, 900 Alabama Avenue. That is the house that, no matter, that's actually one of the houses we do as a walkthrough with all of our new guys, because she's been adopting since, I believe it was 1978. She's been adopting children. She does have two biological kids. One actually works for her son is a lieutenant for Orlando Fire Department, and his son actually works for us. So that's pretty cool. She adopts special needs kids as well. I think our first one was in 1984. And then it's I think that's she has all special needs right now, I believe. But two-story residential home. Our fire marshal back in the day, I don't know if it was late 90s or early 2000s, with the help of Wayne, I think it was Wayne automatic sprinklers, fire sprinklers, they actually installed residential sprinklers in their home. So that's kind of leads up to another portion of the story here. But yeah, it was February 8th, 2020, about 2:30 in the morning. We got a call for our residential house fire, and the firehouse I'm at is 5 blocks over from the home. So we went responding pretty quickly. At the time, we didn't have four engines. All we had was three engines and three rescues. So we called for mutual aid from Osceola County Fire Rescue for another two engines, another two rescues. But it came in, there was an explosion in the home. A bunch of O2 bottles were actually, we found at the end of the fire, the tops of them had blown off. So we don't know if that was, I mean, I'm sure it was, but that possibly could have contributed to the fire. So we get on scene. I was on the rescue at the time. One of my guys that I work with was actually going through medic school. So he was riding as a student with us to knock out his clinical hours. And I hopped out of the rescue and he looks at me and goes, "Hey man, we got a fire." And I'm like, "Well, yeah, no, we have a fire." Crazy enough, there was actually another working house fire 2 blocks over from this Alabama fire we were on. So I called that over the radio. So all the units we requested from the county actually ended up going to the other fire. So we had no mutual aid on this house fire that we had the grabs on. We got there, fully involved attic. Dispatch told us the initial dispatch was there were 6 to 7 kids trapped upstairs, possibly four of them, three or four of them bedridden. So we get there. I run up to my battalion and hand them my TAMs, which are our accountability system. He told me to start a primary search. I did. My partner and I entered the first floor. It was smoky, but decent visibility. And we were told by one of the cops that was on scene that, hey, they're all upstairs. So I was like, all right, we're going up. So you walk through the front door. Stairs are right in front of you. They go up about 6 feet, and then there's a little landing, and they turn right and then finish going upstairs. But when we hit that landing, it was zero visibility. It was just pitch black, couldn't see anything. Heat wasn't too bad because of the sprinkler systems, but I went to go use my tick, and the best way I can describe it was it looked like the screen on a TV when it's all fuzzy and stuff. You just can't use it. So my tick was useless at the time. So then from there, I told my partner, hey, we're down. We're going to traditional search. Can't really use that tick-oriented search. So I hit the first bedroom. I had a lieutenant come up the backside of the structure to the C side, and I entered on the A side. And he went up the C side. He went to the right, and then I went to the room in front of me. And it was, I don't know if them just dumping all the water on it into the attic space or what it was, but it got hot for a moment. So I had my partner stay at the door because I was like, "Hey man, if this ceiling collapses above us, you have an exit straight down the stairs, and I can, get the victim out of the window," because I called for a ladder. So doing a right-hand search in the room, come across a crib. When I felt in the crib, I felt a hand reach up and slap my mask, and I was like, "Oh, this is it. No, I got one." Very different from a mannequin in every way possible. So went to go scoop up my victim. Come to find out, now I didn't know if it was a smoke detectors or what it was, but my victim and another buddy of mine who was on the engine, or it was on another rescue, I'm sorry, that was doing the search, had the same thing. Both our victims were hooked up to ventilators. So we were hearing the ventilators going off. We heard all this going, all the other noises going off, but had to figure out how to, take this vent off the patient essentially. And I ended up cutting the vent tube with a knife I had in my pocket. And then I scooped up, kind of got low, went to the door, straight down the stairs, handed my victim off to one of the rescue crews that was the transport rescue at the time. My lieutenant came down the backside, came around, handed his off, and then he went back inside, and I went back inside to finish where I was. And by that time, another crew had pulled another victim out, went down the seaside as well, dropped his victim off to the rescue. And then I don't know if the fourth victim, we pulled a total of four victims out. I don't remember if he came out the seaside or the A side, but he got his victim out as well. So doing all that, they transported. Luckily, no one died or anything. Everyone's very well and healthy as can be. The hospitals did a great job, taking everyone, getting all that situated with a essentially, I don't want to say an MCI form, but being able to just drop patients off and go back and, hey, we're bringing you three more. They did very well. So it was quite interesting. Definitely not the traditional got a victim, drag them out, and throwing the ventilators and having to figure out how to detach them from that safely without doing any damage to them was something that we've never trained for. And now kind of cool to talk about it and talk different ways of doing it.
Yeah, I'd never come across that ventilator issue. But it's cool that you guys had kind of pre-planned or at least identified that this building was going to be a problem. So victim size, were most of these rescues, were they smaller victims so that dragging out wasn't an issue? Or talk about that a little bit.
So two of them were, they were all older. I believe, I want to say in the 20s, but the mentation of a younger child. I know my victim was, I think, 2 or 210 pounds. My buddy was, who brought his victim out, was about 220 pounds. And the other ones were smaller, 150s, maybe not even that, 130s, 130 pounds, maybe.
Wow, so not the 50-pound or 40-pound dummy that a lot of times we practice with. Were they
No.
slippery at all? Or talk about the drag that you, because you'd mentioned just scooping up. So visually, I'm just thinking you're grabbing like a 40-pound younger kid and going. But talk about your removal a little bit.
So, like I said, mine was actually in a crib, a very large crib. I don't know if it wasn't slippery from what I remember. I know when I first went to go grab the victim, it wasn't too bad, but I think, course, adrenaline's pumping through you, so you're all excited and everything. But yeah, what I the was the slippery wasn't an issue. They were still fully clothed and like night clothes or sleeping clothes, so that wasn't too bad. Ended up getting really low on the ground initially, but as soon as I was having a little bit difficult to kind of rearrange and start to drag, I know I kind of stood up and I duck walked with this 200 plus pound victim just cradling, trying to get there to the door and down the stairs, because it was still good visibility down the stairs once you got there. So the other ones, I know, I believe the one that my buddy dragged for with the ventilator, he did do a drag down the hallway to the seaside and went out that way. And the other two, I'm not sure how they got him out. Didn't really hear about that one.
So for stairs, I'm assuming you were pulling on my head first, so the feet were going down the stairs last. I know that's a question I get a lot.
No. So I actually, when I got to the stairs, I kind of sat on my butt because I still had the victim cradled in my arms, and I kind of slid down the stairs till I got to that landing that I mentioned in the beginning, and then I was able to stand up because it was, the smoke had kind of risen up and was a little more clear. So I was able to stand up on that landing, walk down the stairs, and walk out the front door, which from the start of the stairs to the front door was probably 5, 6 feet.
Nice. You mentioned Seaside. Was there another set of stairs, or was that ladder removal? Or talk about
Yeah,
the Seaside
so
exit.
a couple of the kids were bound to a wheelchair. So there's a set of stairs, but there was also a exterior elevator on the backside. So that's how they moved them up and down. Because all the bedrooms, not all, there was a couple, I believe, from where I remember, maybe downstairs, but mostly upstairs. So they would use the elevator, bring the children up on the second floor, and then they also had a regular stairwell, like a, I don't remember if it was a metal stairwell or a wooden one, but they did have like a traditional stairwell, exterior stairwell on the backside.
Oh, I can only imagine the craziness when you have reports that there's multiple people trapped. This is a pre-plan that you've done, and you know that you've just got a ton of victims. You know, we talked that one of the officer's responsibilities or senior man's responsibilities is to make sure that you're thorough in your search. How do you guys make sure you got thoroughness? You know, you're bringing up one, two, three, four. You know, just talk about that.
So we found out initially a couple kids were able to. There's always a home nurse with them. So she was able to get a couple of the kids out that were downstairs, no issues. It's funny you bring that up because when we pulled the four kids out from the upstairs, I guess she didn't hear, but she kept pointing. There's another one in that room. And she was pointing to the Alpha Bravo corner, so the Alpha quadrant. And we actually went back in probably three times because we're like, there's no one else there. But she didn't count, and we didn't communicate with her that this is who we pulled out. This is, you know, how many we have. So the first primary search, we did pull them all out, but she didn't know that. She kept saying there's one more in there. So we actually, like I said, went back in a couple more times just to check again, and we couldn't find anyone. And then we finally not sat with her, but pulled her and like, look, this is what we got. This is who we brought out. And she's like, oh, okay, that's everyone. So we have it all clear.
That's a great point. You know, we harp a lot of times on bystander reports not being accurate. And a lot of times it's they say everybody's out and they're not. This being a case where they said, no, there's still more inside. So, you know, I think to the point, we're going to go inside, we're going to search everything we can. And then keeping a count or keeping track of how many you've brought out is pretty important because they might be on their way to the hospital. Yeah, that's just part of the deal to make sure we got thoroughness. So that's pretty cool.
It was definitely an experience, definitely a career changing thought, or not thought, but fire.
So as we wrap up, what takeaways have you guys taken from this fire? And like, hey, we had the fire in 2020. It backed up the aggressive search culture that we're going through, and what kind of lessons learned are you using out of that as we teach the new guys?
That no matter what it is, like we have to, you know, anytime we go to a primary search, right, we're not looking for anything small. We're looking for humans, right? Full bodies. So being able just to be a little more rapid and teaching guys to be rapid to get that done and being able to spread out, right? We're not looking for anything small. We're not doing any of that. We're looking for humans. So, and it's a thoroughness, but quickness. We're not trying to identify a computer product, or you know what I mean? It's not going to be a trying to figure out how to word it. We're not trying to, if it doesn't feel like a human, we're moving on. No, we're not trying to guess what we're touching at the time. So coming from that fire, just expecting, especially that fire, expect the unexpected. You don't know what you're going to come up against. So we actually throw random things in when we practice or train on search. So that's one of our main takeaways from that. And then, of course, communication on every fire. You can always do better. And we definitely talk to people more about our new guys. Don't be afraid to get on the radio and be like, hey, what is this? Or what do I have? Or what's missing, essentially.
That's good. I think the last thing I want to ask you about, we don't get a lot of fires in sprinklered buildings. So, you know, typically we've got a set of conditions that we get when we have fire. We've got the smoke is rising and it's hotter up top and our tick's going to work. Can you talk about what the sprinklers being in place did or changed on this fire?
Yeah, so with the sprinklers, the regarding the tick, It completely disoriented the tick. Like I couldn't even use it. Like it looks like a fuzzy TV screen is the best way I could, describe it. You gotta look through it, or go look at your tick, and it was just blank, essentially. And I think the sprinklers for that particular fire was, they helped keep the heat down for sure, but it also kept the smoke down. So it kind of, I guess, hindered us a little bit due to it not allowing the smoke to rise. And it was just, the excess water, obviously, that throws a whole nother ball game in it. Trying to, clear your mask, clear your tick screen. Can't really do that too much, was just the constant flow. So that, I mean, all in all, I think it really did end up helping. In the long run, even though the fire was in the attic, it still kept it in check to whatnot, because there were times that, from the water we were dumping on the attic, that holes would bust through. So that, kept the heat in check. But then again, it's searching in carpet that is soaking wet. We had, I think there was a couple inches of water, about 4 inches of water after our water was being dumped on it, the sprinkler water going through. The second floor started getting weak, so you could feel the sponginess of the floor. So collapse was another probability. But again, it's I would recommend, when I build a house, I'm gonna install them.
Wow. Well, real cool. Well, Craig, I appreciate you reaching out and sharing this story. It's a story. I mean, I'm in Florida, so I'd heard about this. I think it happened right before one of the Orlando Fire conferences, obviously in 2020. And so I kind of heard a little bit about it, but now hearing that full backstory is cool. So many lessons to take away from this one. I think the listeners can listen
Oh,
and
yeah.
gain something from.
Absolutely.
So, thank you for reaching out, and we appreciate it. And I just ask anybody that gets a grab to go, number one, go to Firefighter Rescue Survey and fill out that survey. And if you want to record the podcast, I'm sure there's things that folks can learn. Reach out to me, Nick Ledeen, or Justin McWilliams, and we'd love to record it. Our goal is to put one of these out about every 2 weeks and bring the numbers to life. And hopefully, you can take away something that will stick and you can use in your next fire. So, until next time, get after it.
Yeah.